Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Happy Labor Day, everyone. Good morning. Thank you for joining us on this Labor Day. And we are not here live today, but we thought we would take the opportunity on this day off from work to help out some of you who don't have work and are looking. Now, in July, we did a series of segments with Nick Corcadillos of AskTheHeadHunter.com, and we got lots of positive feedback. So all this hour, we will highlight some of his best advice from those four segments, starting with his basic advice for anyone trying to work their way from a job interview or a temporary consultant gig to a full-time position with a company.
What I try to teach people is that when you go in to talk with an employer, the absolute worst thing you can do is sit with your hands folded and answer questions. When a consultant goes in to try to sell a consulting contract to a company, it really is a sales call. And the consultant shows up and basically indicates to the employer that they have studied, researched the company's business, the problems, the challenge that the company is facing. And then the consultant proceeds to outline sort of a mini business plan about how he or she intends to help solve these problems, do this specific job, and contribute something to the department's bottom line. Most job hunters go into interviews expecting to just answer what I refer to as the top 10 stupid interview questions. You know, if you could be any animal, what animal would you be? Where do you see yourself in 5 years? You know, the answer to that one usually is, well, gee, where is your company going to be in business in 5 years? So what I try to get across to people, Brian, is that consultants who are good at what they do don't apply for jobs at companies. They go in and try to show a company how they're going to contribute profit to the bottom line. That's what a regular job hunter needs to be doing. And unfortunately, the employment system brainwashes people to think that you go in and you recite your resume and your history and your skills.
Well, what does it mean in today's economy to brand yourself as a consultant?
I think it's a very realistic reaction to what's happened over the past 10 years, not only in the economy, but in American business. I think we have so many consultants out there nowadays because 5 or 6 years ago, when things were good and things were hopping, people realized they could make more money by starting their own businesses. They realized there was very little loyalty between employers and employees anymore, so they decided to step out on their own. Those people are still out there now. Some of them are having a tough time because they're not good at marketing and sales. Others are doing quite well. I think we're going to see, as people fall off the employment ranks, I think we're going to see more and more consultants because people will realize it's almost, I don't want to say it's easier to get a job as a consultant, but it's almost a more honest thing to do, and it's almost safer because you have more control over your future.
Are there certain fields where this is a good idea or not a good idea?
It's almost always been good in high tech because companies, as technology advances very, very quickly and what's hot continually changes, I think being a consultant and being able to go in and hone in on a specific problem a company has, it's a great way to get a job. I think in other areas we're going to start seeing it happen more often simply because companies cannot withstand the overhead costs of having full-time employees.
Are there well, I know someone who was recently laid off and offered by her employer to stay on for 3 months as a consultant to help finish a project. In that case, it was the same money but no benefits. Does that kind of thing happen a lot?
It's happening more and more, Brian. Again, it all goes back to the simple economics of having a consultant on board or having an employee. When you have a consultant, benefits aren't paid. When you let them go, there's no unemployment to be paid. The CFO at the company loves having consultants because companies usually look at their revenue per employee. The fewer employees you have, the higher your revenue per employee is. That winds up looking better to the stockholders. It winds up looking better to the rest of management. So using people as consultants is a sort of a quick and dirty way for companies to decrease their costs.
That's some doorbell you got there, or is that your cell phone ringtone?
No, it's actually my clock. I apologize.
Wow, and your clock goes off at 46 minutes past the hour.
It's 1 minute off. It goes off every quarter hour. I just moved out of the room. Sorry about that.
Nick Corcadillos, host of AskTheHeadHunter.com, and today we're talking particularly about whether you should become a consultant if you're unemployed. By the way, my friend, who I just mentioned, felt too taken advantage of and actually turned it down, staying on as a consultant for another 3 months without benefits before finally getting laid off. And she just took her severance pay and went out to look for work. Is that ever a good idea from Ask the Headhunter's point of view?
I tell people, Brian, you shouldn't follow anyone's advice about job hunting and hiring, including mine. You have to make a decision based on your own good judgment. Personally, I think she probably made a mistake, because I think she's going to find that companies more and more are hiring consultants and contractors rather than full-time employees. It probably would have been a good way for her to get her feet wet as a consultant in an organization where she's already well-known.
James in Basking Ridge, you're on WNYC. You want to ask the headhunter?
Oh, hi. Yes, thank you very much. Well, I think I'm at the other flip side of your situation. I've been self-employed for 16 years in a small software company. My wife lost her job back in February, and my industry has sort of dried up, so I'm looking to actually get a job. But I find that nobody will apparently look at my resume because I've been self-employed for all this time. So is there a downside to going out on that consulting route for a while when you want to get back into sort of a regular job situation? Because I can't get anybody to respond to me at all, if you had any advice on that.
Again, I think the problem is that companies are trying to save money, and so they're probably looking more at contractors than they are at full-time employees. In the situation of a consultant, I think you have the kinds of contacts and probably a network that most job hunters would kill to have. What I would encourage you to do is throw your resume out the window. Forget about your resume. It can be a horrible crutch. And instead of sending out resumes and responding to job boards, start working through your contacts. And by your contacts, I don't mean that a contact's going to hire you. There's a wonderful book that was written a few years ago called 6 Degrees, The Science of a Connected Age by Duncan Watts, which basically points out that the 6 degrees of separation business is all very useful only if you understand that the contacts that are likely to be most productive for you are out on the periphery of your network. It's not the people in your Rolodex. It's the people that those in your Rolodex know who can introduce you to.
You know, I mentioned on the show the other day a new post on our Uncommon Economic Indicators page. A listener named Kathleen wrote that an unscientific survey of colleagues has confirmed my suspicion, she wrote, that many businesses are soliciting proposals as a way to bridge knowledge and staffing gaps. Consultants and small service agencies are particularly vulnerable to this practice, such as the prospective clients accepted the proposal, then announced that they would be doing the project in-house with freelancers. Basically, they use the proposal process as a way to acquire the strategy and planning for free. Then she writes, an extreme case was where the executive who solicited the proposal presented it as his own, using it to launch his consulting career with a former employer. Do you know if that kind of thing really goes on?
It absolutely goes on, Brian. On AskTheHeadHunter.com, I teach people that the best way to get a job is to go to a company and do the job in the interview. And what that basically means is go in and show your stuff, provide answers, solutions. But you need to draw a line. You want to give them a taste and get them interested. You want to tease them. If you give them the whole solution up front to impress them, they're likely to rip it off. And it's a sad state of affairs, but it happens.
Rowena in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hello, Rowena.
Hi, thank you very much for taking my call. I have worked in public relations and marketing for more than 15 years. And about 3 years ago, I had a baby, and now he's, like, entering school, and so I'm going to be looking to go back to work. And I've been doing consulting since I left work full-time, but in the past 3 years, PR marketing has changed immensely with the introduction of social networking, you know, via the Internet with Facebook and Twitter and LinkedIn, et cetera. And I feel like I can basically not re-enter PR as at the same level that I was at before.
So what's your question?
So I'm thinking I should retrain myself. I should get, you know, web design class or something. So I looked online searching for this, and Brooklyn College offers it through Ed2Go. And do you think it's a worthwhile investment to do this? Because you have to lay out money, like, to get Dreamweaver, to get Photoshop, you know, to buy all this stuff, which totals about $3,000. I mean, do you think it's a good investment to learn web design?
I'll tell you what my mentor at Stanford told me. I was in the graduate school of psychology a long time ago at Stanford, and I took courses in the business school, and my mentor was in the biz school. And I said to him one day, Gene, I said, I want to leave the psych department. I want to get an MBA. Can you get me into the MBA program? Mm-hmm. He said, Nick, what do you want to do that for? He said, whatever's going on out in the business world that's hot and really cool, it's what everybody wants, by the time we can put together courses to teach this stuff, it's already been gone.
Yeah.
It's already passed by. What I would suggest you do, instead of doing all of that, and I don't mean to knock education. Courses can be great. Spend time on the social networking sites. Figure out how they work, and then ask yourself how you could use those tools and techniques to show a company how to improve its corporate image. Again, it comes back to not preparing yourself to get into a job and trying to bolster yourself and your skills. It's much more important to figure out what problems and challenges does a specific company that you want to work for face. And then you can go back and figure out, okay, here's what I have to marshal and put together to be able to deal with that.
Good luck, Rowena. Thank you for calling us. Nick Korkadilis, my guest, host of Ask the Headhunter at Korkadilis.com or AskTheHeadhunter.com. We're talking today about the question, if you're unemployed, should you become a consultant? And Sean in Cherry Hill, you're on WNYC with Nick. Hi, Sean.
Hi, Sean.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What's the question?
My question was, I was recently laid off by a big biotech company, and I went the route of becoming a consultant. But the only thing now is that I only have one big client, and I was wondering what I could do to make sure that if this client doesn't need me anymore, I'm not unemployed again. What are some things I could do to, in terms of marketing and sales, so I can gain other clients?
You need to meet more people who do the work you do. And again, this means forgetting about job postings and forgetting about looking for what's open. I would spend time, whatever your area of specialization is, find discussion boards and forums online where people who do what you do get together to talk about their work. As you start answering questions that people post there, as you start participating in that community, you'll get to know people. And then what you do is you ask them for a little advice and insight about the companies they work for. And the next thing you know, you're more likely to get recommended or to get a little bit of a reference touch from these people to help you get in the door with the companies they work for. It's all about personal contacts. Job boards fill only about 1% to 2% of positions that companies need to have filled. Most jobs are filled through personal contacts and who you know.
Nick Korkadilis of AskTheHeadhunter.com, Brian Lehrer on WNYC. And all this hour, we are bringing you highlights from the series we did in July with Nick, answering your job search questions. We'll be back in a minute on this Labor Day. Stay tuned. Brian Lehrer on WNYC on Labor Day with highlights from our discussions from our July series with Nick Korkadilis of AskTheHeadhunter.com, giving you advice on how to find work and get ahead. It's Labor Day, but you want to work. Let's get right into some of the discussion we had during Nick's second visit to the show when I asked him about how to shine on job boards, those online receiving houses for resumes and job postings. I asked him why he is skeptical of job boards, which he is, and whether he thinks it's easy to get lost in that sea of postings online.
It's not just a question of getting lost. It's a question of how the job boards actually perform, Brian. What's interesting is that back in 2000, a market research firm called Forrester Research up in Boston did a survey of job hunters and employers and asked them how effective online job hunting and hiring really was. And what's interesting is they found that only about 4% of people who were job hunting said they found their jobs online. Now, that's back in 2000. There's another company called Career Crossroads based in New Jersey that's done the only longitudinal study of job board performance. And what's interesting is that over the succeeding 9 years, including this past year, they report right about the same percentage of people finding their jobs and companies hiring. So only between 1.5% to 3.5% of jobs that companies post or actually fill are actually filled through job boards. So when you look at those statistics, they're absolutely dismal. On the flip side, studies over the same period show that most jobs are found and filled through, guess what, personal contacts.
So these numbers that you gave us are pretty staggeringly low. The percentage of hires made through Monster, a whopping 1.4%. Hot Jobs, 0.39% of hires. Career Builder, 0.29%. Headhunter.net, 0.27. In other words, 0.25%. Wow.
I'll tell you what absolutely cracks me up is that when you look at HR departments who were also polled and asked, which of the boards do you have most of your contracts with for recruiting, the ones that perform the worst are the ones that have the most contracts with human resources departments in American business.
But it's not like it's a complete waste of time, right? It just takes a few minutes to put your resume up there, and somebody's getting jobs through those things, whoever those, you know, 0.25% people are, and Monster seems to do six times better than the other ones.
Whenever I do a live presentation and I talk to job hunters, I always poll people for a show of hands who found a job through a job board. There's always one or two people out of 50 or 100 who tell me they found one that way. What I try to get across to them is if you want to do it intelligently, there are different kinds of job boards. The major job boards tend to be the worst performing. The better job boards tend to be the niche job boards, which attract people who work in a particular industry or professional area, who tend to aggregate around those boards because they also have discussion areas. People tend to hang around and talk to one another. And then most significant are companies' own hiring websites. Something like 20% of positions that companies fill tend to come from their own job postings on their own corporate websites. So if you're going to do it, you want to get as close as you can to the company, to the specific industry, through a niche board, rather than going to these huge free-for-all sites that really don't produce much at all.
That's good advice about the niche job boards, I think. Let's take a phone call. Claire in Westfield. You're on WNYC. Hi, Claire.
Hi, how are you?
Good. How are you doing?
Claire.
I'm doing well, thank you. I just have a question about submitting resumes and cover letters. I was wondering if it's preferred to submit them via regular mail or internet, email.
When you submit them to whom? To a job board or to a company?
To a company. If you're doing a direct mailing, would it be better to do it via email or snail mail?
If I were going to use a resume at all, which I wouldn't, and I'll tell you in a minute why, if I were to use a resume at all, I would probably send it in by U.S. mail for the simple fact that everyone else is using email. Now, email is efficient. I love email. But if you were to send something in via U.S. mail, I think you'll find it might get a little more attention because it's going to be on a shorter stack.
Okay.
But beware when you do that. It's easy to blast out 1,000 resumes by just hitting the enter key on your keyboard. If you're going to send one out by U.S. mail, now you have to go through a lot more trouble, which forces you, and this is the good old days approach of actually having to stop and think and carefully choose, what companies are you going to go after? So this has a nice bit of fallout on the positive side for you, because it's going to force you to stop and think about who you're sending those resumes to.
But
that, I believe, will increase your chances.
Shouldn't she do both? Send it via email and send a copy in snail mail?
You can. I mean, Brian, I tend to look at this from the standpoint of where am I going to invest my effort and make the most intelligent approach. If I blast it out via email, that's fine. It'll wind up in a stack somewhere. But there's also a danger. If HR receives your email resume and processes it quickly using a machine and they discard it, they put an X on it. It gets tagged no. Then your paper resume comes in. Someone looks up your name and they find you've already been rejected. It's easy to put you aside.
Mm. Yeah, or you just say in the cover letter, I've also submitted by email, and in the email version, I'm also sending a U.S. mail version, so they don't think you're trying to circumvent something, but it shows some effort.
I agree. But one way is playing the odds, because you're competing with literally tens of thousands of people,
right,
while the other is more direct and personal.
Yeah. Claire, good luck.
Yeah. Thank you.
Now, what about that little bombshell you dropped in there? Don't use resumes?
Don't use resumes. When a company turns to job boards or to want ads or to the traditional channel for finding people, what they wind up getting is lots and lots of input. They get hundreds of resumes, thousands of applicants, and they might spend $10 or $20 per resume that they're getting. On the flip side, companies also go to headhunters, whom they might pay $20,000 to $30,000 to fill a position. What do they get in exchange for that? They get two or three applicants, two or three candidates who've already been vetted. If you're going to go the resume route, I think you're playing in the mass market. Far more intelligent and focused, I think, and it also goes back to what I was saying to Claire about your motivation and picking companies carefully. Go talk to the companies you want to work for. Triangulate. Figure out who knows the company. Talk to their vendors. Talk to their customers. Talk to their lawyer. Talk to their real estate agent, whoever rents them their building. Talk to people who work there and try to triangulate on the manager who has an open position and get yourself introduced. Far more effective. Now you're dealing with the 40 to 70% of positions that are filled with personal contacts. You increase your odds dramatically.
All right, listeners, you ready to throw out your resume and do it that way? 212-433-WNYC. And let's see, we'll get back to another caller in a minute. I got to ask you about something on your Ask the Headhunter website. One of your features, top 10 stupid interview questions. And number 8 is one that a recruiter asked one of your readers, who you call Mr. Angry. And the question was, how would you move Mount Fuji a half a kilometer to the south? And part of Mr. Angry's let's come back to reality response, you said, was, how could that possibly benefit the business? Now, that's a pretty daring thing for somebody at a job interview to say. I assume you don't actually recommend that. But why would a recruiter ask how to move Mount Fuji?
Well, let me go back to what you just said. I would recommend that, and here's why. When you go to a company, they're assessing you. They're interviewing you. You're also there to assess and interview them. And I can't tell you, between my blog, email I get, my newsletter, Brian, how many people are becoming much more assertive and basically saying to an employer, yes, I might love to work here, but I need to know that you guys are worthy of having me. And does that sound aggressive? I just think it's assertive. If you're going to work for a company, what you want to do in the interview is somehow, politely, I'm not suggesting getting the interviewer upset or being rude, you want to turn the conversation away from the top 10 stupid interview questions and to one very specific question. You want to say to the manager, if you were to hire me, can you tell me what task it is that you would want me to do? And let me show you how I would go about doing it for you profitably. So you're turning away from silly, canned interview questions. And you're talking about the work you do best, the work they need to have done. You stop sweating. You stop being nervous because now you're talking about what you're really good at. And it puts the interview on a totally different footing.
Mm-hmm. Right. I guess if you're in the mountain moving business, then the Mount Fuji question is pretty relevant. If you're in the restaurant business, not so much. Andy in Norwalk, you're on WNYC. Hi, Andy.
Hi, Brian. I had a quick – we actually do a lot of hiring, and I use headhunters. I use niche job boards. I use large job boards.
For what?
One comment and one question.
For what kind of business, if I may ask?
I have a restaurant group. So we hire top management. We hire, you know, daily workers, everything in between.
And you don't move a lot of mountains?
No.
It just feels...
there's some customers for whom we move.
It feels night. Like you do every night. Anyway,
yeah.
Go ahead.
The comment was I've never understood how these objectives get to the top of resumes or what people are being told is their purpose. It's one of the things that drives me absolutely nuts with the resume is reading that little one-paragraph objective. So if I can suggest anything to anyone listening, it would be, you know, if you can distill it to a sentence, good, and then if you can throw that sentence away, even better. But
thank you, Andy.
My question is this. We've had, for whatever reason, I have good luck with headhunters. I'm a good headhunter, but Craigslist tends to produce the top caliber of candidate. I know it's a sort of large job board that he was saying doesn't produce quality, but we've had a great deal of luck with Craigslist. I'm wondering what his view on that is.
Thank you very much.
Craigslist does tend to perform better, and I believe it or not, Andy, I consider Craigslist a smaller job board. I think it tends to attract people who are a little bit more serious, a little bit more savvy about using the Internet. It's not really viewed as a job board. It's more sort of a community buying and trading and meeting people area. So I'm not at all surprised with that. Your comment about objectives is absolutely dead on. There's a little article on AskTheHeadHunter.com titled Put a Free Sample in Your Resume that basically says, rather than using an objective statement, which is generic, anyone who reads it and it says, I want to work with great people and advance my career in a good environment, so what? Instead, turn that into a value offered statement that basically says, I've studied your company, or it shows that you've studied the target company a bit, and what you want to do is explain how you're going to help bring additional success and profit to this company's bottom line. Very, very different from an objective.
All right. We're going to run out of time in a couple of minutes. I want to mention to our listeners that Nick, in addition to running AskTheHeadHunter.com and his latest book, How to Work with Headhunters, but let's get one more in here on job boards. Aura in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Real quick.
Yeah, hi. I had two comments. One was that I did get my job by posting on Monster.com, and I think that probably it has a lot to do with what you're looking for. I'm a physical therapist, and they like to gobble us up pretty quick. So.
Absolutely. You're booming.
a little push for PTs. But the other observation was that just a couple of weeks ago, I think you had a recruiter for some company on talking about how what she looks for. And she said that, you know, the snail mail resume comes in and goes directly into the recycling bin, that she doesn't even bother because she's got so many resumes online to look at. She doesn't even bother looking at the snail mail.
Nick, real quick.
What I would say to you is I have a problem with that kind of recruiter because they're processing bulk. They're not very focused. I suggest to you that only about 5% of headhunters are worth working with, and that's because they're the ones who are actually focused on specific real assignments that they have from their client companies. They will read your snail mail.
Aura, good luck. Give me a 10-second answer to Mark in Manhattan, who we're not going to have time to put on the air. He asks, since you like niche job boards, what do you think about paying to be on a niche job board?
I would never pay to be on any job board. The only job board I know that seems to be clean, there's one called LinkUp, which nowadays I think is the best board up there because it basically focuses on positions they get directly from companies.
So they've already got the positions.
They've already got the positions. But paying to be on a board, I look at the ladders, for example. There's a discussion on my Ask the Headhunter blog. There are over 100 postings from people who are complaining about the fact the ladders charges money but does not deliver the jobs that they promise.
Nick Korkadelis, AskTheHeadhunter.com, and his new book, How to Work with Headhunters. He'll keep coming on to talk about looking for work. Again, Nick, thanks so much.
Good to be with you, Brian.
Brian Lehrer, WNYC. Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and time once again to chat with Nick Korkadelis from AskTheHeadhunter.com. Welcome back to WNYC.
Good morning, Brian. Good to talk to you again.
And when we asked you off the air what you might want to talk about today, you kind of turned the mirror on yourself and said, what good are headhunters anyway? So that's brave of you. And tell our listeners the basics here. What is a headhunter, and who should use a headhunter?
Number one, a headhunter is a consultant who is hired by a company to fill very specific positions. The big misconception, Brian, among people is that headhunters are out here to help them find jobs. If we were to try to do that, we would quickly go out of business. So the misnomer is that the term headhunter is applied to all kinds of career services practitioners, from career counselors and coaches to employment agencies. The stark fact is that only about 3 or 4% of jobs are filled by actual headhunters. However, employment agencies, which are also called headhunters sometimes, consulting companies, which are also called headhunters, tend to fill quite a few jobs. And it's important for people to understand the differences between all these kinds of organizations and how they operate if they want to leverage a headhunter to get a good job.
And you told us that a lot of times a headhunter will post on a job board, but those posts can actually be scams?
Yeah, what basically happens is that what we used to say when I started working as a headhunter in Silicon Valley is that the cost of entry to the headhunting business was so low that anyone could do it. Back in those days, all you needed was a couple of dimes and a pencil. You would work out of a phone booth and write on the wall. Unfortunately, that attracts a lot of quick buck artists who will basically take job listings they find anywhere online or in newspaper ads. They will post them themselves, solicit resumes, and when they get applicants, they basically blast thousands and thousands of these applicants' resumes to companies they have no relationships with. And the result is they're hoping to get a hit, a placement, some sort of a fee. This winds up frustrating job hunters. This is primarily why, after a headhunter talks to you and tells you they've got a great job for you, they get your resume, you answer a lot of questions, then they never call you back. That's why.
But they want the fee. So isn't it in their interest to place you?
It's in their interest, if they're not legitimate headhunters, to get as many resumes out to as many companies as possible because it's like buying a lottery ticket. So they're not really helping. The good ones have established relationships and contracts with companies who have assigned them to go out and fill actual positions. Being able to tell the difference is often the difference between frustration and success.
So, listeners, here's the topic for the next few minutes. Who should you ask for help when you're looking for a job? What kind of professional services should people actually turn to? And we're going to get more of that answer from Nick Orkadilis here. But if you have questions about who to turn to for help, give us a call if you're unemployed or concerned about somebody who is. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. And where do you begin to answer that question, Nick? If somebody is starting to look for a job and wants some advice, wants some coaching, maybe has some money to pay a consultant in the, you know, job search process, who should they turn to?
You can start out doing it for free by going to the library and picking out any of the many books about job hunting that you can find. You can use AskTheHeadhunter.com for free, where I basically try to teach people how to be their own headhunters, because it's not rocket science. It all is based on two things. One is circulating in your professional community and hanging around with the people who do the work you want to do. And second, it's about being able to show a company how you're going to help drop profit to their bottom line if they hire you. That's what I coach my candidates to do. Anyone can do that for themselves. You don't need a headhunter. I'm not selling headhunting services to anyone here. All I'm trying to do is show people how to do it on their own. So go to the free sources first.
Let's take a phone call from Bob in Manhattan. Bob, you're on WNYC.
Hi, good morning. Thank you very much. This is a wonderful public service, and I just wanted to find out if you could give me some tips and or advice. I have a telephone interview today and an in-person interview tomorrow, and my problem sometimes is that I talk too much, and I'm wondering if I should just answer the questions quickly and directly and then wait for the next question.
Are you interviewing on the phone with a human resources rep, or are you talking to a hiring manager?
I'm talking to a hiring manager today and another hiring manager tomorrow. Today's on the phone, tomorrow's in person.
What I would do on the phone, because you can't see body language signals, is basically listen patiently, let the manager ask what the manager wants to ask, and at an appropriate point, interject and say to the manager, look, I want to make our discussion today and our meeting tomorrow as profitable for you as possible. So what I'd like to ask you is to lay out one or two live issues, problems, or challenges that you would want your new hire to tackle when you hire someone. And I'd like to show you and explain to you how I would go about it. Obviously, I can't, you know, do it on the phone, but I'd like to give you an outline of how I would approach this so you can begin to understand how I might fit into your organization in a profitable way.
Okay.
Bob, good luck. And by the way, our chief call screener says, watch out for phone breathing in a telephone interview. Talk into the mouthpiece, but exhale away from it. I don't know if that ever comes up for you, Nick, but in the
heavy
talk,
breathing doesn't work.
In the talk radio business, this is a periodic problem, let us say. Alex and Chelsea, you got called by a headhunter yesterday?
Yeah, I responded to an ad on Craigslist, and this woman called me, but then she knew nothing about my industry, it seemed like she knew nothing about the job she was hiring for. Ended up being very aggressive towards me. It was a very odd experience.
What did she want you to do?
I guess it was like a pre-screen, and then she was going to ostensibly pass my resume on to the employer. But I work in the restaurant industry, and she said, well, why do you want to work in the restaurant industry? It's a failing industry. And
jeez.
I said, well, what are you talking about? You just told me you're hiring for a $15 million project.
Jeez. So, Nick, is this an interaction that you recognize?
Yeah, I absolutely. It happens all the time. Alex, what's happening here is you have someone who – I don't want to say this is a scammer. This is someone who is inexperienced, doesn't really know what they're doing, and is just scrambling to get names and resumes of people, hoping she'll find one that might fit, that her client might be interested in, but she's not really doing any screening. She's not telling you anything about the company. The smartest thing to do is two things. One, ask for information, as I said to the previous caller, about the problems and challenges that the employer is facing that she, as the headhunter, would like you to be able to go in and solve. If she can't answer the question, you're wasting your time, because she's not going to prepare you to go into the interview and say anything useful. You're going to be on your own. Second, I would ask her for a couple of references, companies she works with and candidates she has placed that you can check with. And I would just say to her very politely, look, I get a lot of calls from headhunters, and I need to screen them. Can you please provide me with some references? That'll tell you everything in the world, because she probably won't give you any.
That's a good one. Alex, thank you. Good luck. Kathy in Eastchester, you're on WNYC. Hi, Kathy.
Hi. I have a friend who put his resume on a job board, and he got an email response back saying, we have an interview for you, but we need to do a credit check first before the job interview. Is that standard?
That's called identity theft.
Okay, that's
there
what
are,
we thought.
There are a lot of scammers out there. Imagine someone calls you and offers to sell you a vacation timeshare. You have no idea who they are. Are you going to provide them with your credit card number, with credit information, with personal information about yourself? Of course not. People get desperate when they're hunting for a job, and when someone calls claiming to have an interview for you, how can they have an interview for you if they don't know who you are? So I would tell your friend to just drop it.
Kathy, thank you very much. Nick Korkadelis from AskTheHeadHunter.com, our guest on WNYC. Hala in Montclair, you're on WNYC. Hello, Hala.
Hi, how are you? I'm a recruiter for Applied Technologies, and an IT company, and I want to complain about other so-called headhunters because they make my job as somebody who is legitimate a lot harder.
Thank you.
Because they send these, like you said, hundreds or thousands of emails without having to really go through the resumes and call the candidates and find the right person for the right job. And me, on the other hand, who takes time in finding the right candidate, my resumes that I worked hard for end up being piled up at the very bottom of the list. So, yeah, they get – so that makes my job a lot harder, and I have to race against time to find the right candidate while by somebody else just kind of, you know, throws in those resumes and maybe gets a call.
Any advice, Nick, for a legitimate recruiter?
A legitimate recruiter should offer references and provide information about where she's located, talk about some companies you've worked for, basically try to let the person you're talking to know that you're for real. In my new book, How to Work with Headhunters, I offer a crib sheet that basically helps people ask the right kinds of questions in order to vet a headhunter. Part of that crib sheet is available on howtoworkwithheadhunters.com. You can download it and look at it. But what I basically try to teach people is, here's a handful of questions you can ask to make sure that this person is legitimate, that they're not going to waste your time.
Okay, good luck, Hala. Maggie in Totowa, you're on WNYC. Oh, Maggie went away. All right, let's try Moses in Rigo Park. Moses, you're on WNYC.
Hello, how are you?
Good, thanks.
Hi, Moses.
Well, basically, I have immigrated recently to the United States, and I have all my papers, you know, my green card and Social Security number.
Where are you from, Moses?
I am from Peru, South America.
Welcome to New York.
Oh, thank you very much. But you see, even though I have made some research about work research here in New York City and in the United States, I have found that it's very hard to know where to start, and I want to have an idea of about my experience. I mean, I have worked all my whole life outside the United States, and how will that affect my employability in order to, well, you know, to get a job and also to get some references in order to have a successful interview?
It's such an important question for the city of immigrants. Nick Korkadelis, how can you help Moses?
Moses, you need to establish credibility and relationships within the professional community that you want to work in. Whether it's in New York or anywhere in the United States, you need to hook up with people who do the kind of work you want to do. And you can start doing that by visiting professional websites, industry websites, where there are discussion forums, where people are talking with one another about their work, about projects they're working on, about problems they're facing. They ask one another questions about the technology they're working on. As you participate on these sites, you become more and more recognized as a legitimate expert in the field. You can then start asking questions about companies that are hiring, which companies are good to work for. On the real life side, you should start attending professional events, conferences, training programs. Often you can get into these at reduced costs. If you're a member of a particular alumni group or some kind of special group, it can be less expensive to do it. But the key is to start spending time with people who are in your profession in a more social and professional environment. That's how you start making connections and establishing your own credibility.
Moses, good luck out there. David in Boca Raton, you're going to be our last caller. You got to ask your question in 20 seconds. Can you do it?
Okay. Real quick. Yes, I'm up for a position at a company significant in my market space. They flew me out to their headquarters where I interviewed with seven people. The results were all positive. The headhunter called and asked me for references, which I provided. And I had heard, I know the references were positive.
What's your question?
I'm sorry, the question is, did I provide references too soon in the absence of a written offer?
Not necessarily. No, if they've asked you for it and if things have gone well, you did the right thing. What I would do is make sure you talk to your references, let them know what the position is, and help them talk out loud about the reasons why they think you would make a good fit in the position. Once they say it out loud, when they get the phone call, they will likely use the same words with the employer or with the headhunter. Beyond that, you're going to have to sit tight and wait.
Real quick, can you use a headhunter as a negotiating tactic? Can you leverage them against an employer for better salary or benefits?
Absolutely. If you're working with a headhunter and you're getting a job offer, you can work with the headhunter very effectively to try to convince the company to give you more money by using a very simple approach. You want to sit down with the headhunter on the phone or in person, whatever, and outline together what the problems and challenges are that the employer's facing, and you need to show how you're going to do it.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and we will take the last few minutes of this hour on Labor Day to bring you a little bit more from Nick Korkadilis' time with us throughout the month of July. Here's a bit from when he joined us at our Jerome L. Green performance space, our new performance space on Barrack Street in Lower Manhattan. In front of a live audience, I began by asking him about looking for new work and disclosing your previous salary and why it's such a taboo subject. Here's Nick.
Gives people the willies. When an employer asks you what your prior or current salary is, people have said to me, ask me, are you legally required to divulge this information? And I tell them, no, you don't have to divulge anything you don't want to. Once you divulge your current or past salary, that absolutely will affect the job offer that you will get. So what I advise people to do is never, ever disclose your past or current salary.
You can really decline to reveal that information?
If you do, you can always decline, but if you decline politely and respectfully and in a compelling way, most employers I found, according to my readers, will absolutely back off.
Should you lie?
Absolutely not, because if you do, once you get hired, although there's no real legal repercussion if you lie, if you get hired, most companies will then ask you for copies of your past pay stubs. Once you deliver those, now you're subject to being terminated because you violated the rules of engagement.
And you write on your blog that, quote, in my opinion, your salary is an irrelevant measure of your worth outside the confines of your place of employment.
Sure, because you stop and think about what an individual is being paid is determined by the company you're working for, the work that you're doing for that particular organization. You move on to another organization, your value may be very different. So when a company looks at your past salary and tries to judge how qualified you are, how good you would be at the job at that company, what they're really doing is looking at what their competitor's judgment is. And if the person's leaving the competitor, do you really want to judge this person based on what someone else says about them? Or do you want to exert some kind of marginal advantage and edge that you have in making a better judgment about the person?
Audience here at the Green Space, if you have a question for Nick Korkadilis from AskTheHeadHunter.com, an author of the book Ask the Headhunter, you can raise your hand and we'll come around to you with a microphone. In the meantime, we have a caller, Lisa in Manhattan. You're on WNYC. Hi, Lisa.
Hi, how are you?
Good, and you?
Fine, thank you. Shall I just give you my question?
Jump right in.
I used to work in the TV business as a producer, and I would have a headhunter call me about once a month. And now that I really need a job and I'm looking for a job, I don't know how to find a headhunter that specializes in my area. And then I like to get them to be interested in representing me. Any hints?
What you really want to do is ask yourself, what two or three companies would you want to work for? Pick up the phone and make calls to try to identify the manager in that network that you would want to work for. Get a hold of the manager or someone who works with the manager and ask them, what headhunters do you use to fill positions in jobs like this?
Right.
It's an unusual kind of call because people don't expect it. Typically, they'll tell you who they use because they don't know why you're asking. And if the phone call goes well, a smart manager will ask you, gee, why are you asking? Then you tell them, now you have an in, and you potentially give the manager the opportunity to interview and hire someone without a headhunter fee.
That's a great idea.
Lisa, thank you. Good luck.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
You're welcome.
And everybody else can steal that idea for free, too. We have a question from an audience member here in the Jerome L. Green Performance Space. Hi.
Hi, Nick. Hi, Brian. I have a question. Many headhunters will ask you to give your minimum salary requirement, and it's a very difficult question to answer because you don't want to lowball the offer, you don't want to go too high and disqualify yourself. What do you recommend in these situations?
Again, I recommend you do not disclose what your current or past salary is, but I think it's incumbent on you to try to figure out what you think you're looking for. If the headhunter's a good one, the headhunter will not use that information to get you lowballed by the employer because his or her fee is based on what the employer is going to pay you. So you want to ask the headhunter, how are you going to use this information, and are you going to disclose it? If you're not, if we can keep this close, then I'm willing to discuss it with you. But you need to have some idea of what you're looking for.
Thank you. Now, what if you're, say, a finalist for a job, you've done an interview or two, and you know you're in the mix, What's your advice about how much follow-up you should do at that stage in the process, or how? What can you do to help yourself, and how have you seen people hurt themselves at that point?
People hurt themselves when they don't follow up at all. So that kind of puts that to rest. There's this magical thing called the thank you note, which people always ask, should I send a thank you note? Should I send a thank you email? And the answer is absolutely always yes. But a thank you note by itself is virtually useless because it's just a courtesy. When you send a thank you note, ask yourself, what do I know or what do I have in my possession? What have I read recently that might be potentially useful information for this manager? Attach a clipping, attach a link, and explain how you think the information could be useful to the manager so that when you send it in, the manager knows you're thinking about his or her work.
Sean in the Bronx. You're on WNYC with Nick Corcadillos from AskTheHeadHunter.com. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
Hi, Sean.
Hi. Question for you. I did receive a job offer recently, and I'm quite happy with the salary. So I'm wavering between whether or not I should negotiate for more or should I just go ahead and negotiate because that's the expected thing to do. You want to seem as though you know you should negotiate because you don't want to leave any money on the table.
That's something I talk about on every web article I have and in both of my books. You don't need to negotiate just because you think you should. You know, a lot of books and advisors say you should always negotiate because you can always get more money. In my opinion and my experience, negotiating might get you a marginally higher salary, but you also have to ask yourself, if you get too pushy, you might put the employer off. Even if you get hired, it could damage your relationship. Most important, if you can't justify in terms of how it's going to benefit the employer, then you shouldn't ask for more money.
Okay, great.
Sean, good luck.
Thank you.
Cecil in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Cecil.
Good morning. I was wondering what the guest feels about reapplying to a job on an internet job board that has come back up, even though you never heard anything back from your initial inquiry. And you made the reference about, you know, go after jobs that you want. Well, this is something that I would be perfect for, and I think I'm incredibly well suited for what this particular employer want, yet the job has been reposted again, and I never even heard back from my first inquiry. I'll listen off the air to figure out to take your answer.
Thanks a lot for calling,
Cecil. In another episode of the show, we talked about job boards a lot, and what I pointed out is the surveys show that job boards only fill somewhere between 0.5% to about 4% of positions that companies are actually filling. Companies have a habit of recycling old jobs like bad pennies. They just keep posting them over and over and over again. My advice to you is, if you saw a job that you think you're interested in, forget about the job board. Start working backwards. Research the company. Triangulate. Try to identify people who do some sort of business with that company, either employees, vendors who sell stuff to them, customers who buy stuff from them, their lawyers, their attorneys, their rental agent, someone who does business with the company. Contact them and ask them for insight about the organization and for an introduction to the manager that you'd want to work with.
All right, Cecil, good luck to you. And Charlie in Portchester, you're on WNYC. Hi, Charlie.
Hi, guys. Hi. Can you hear me okay? The screener said volume was low on my phone.
Sounds great right now.
Okay, great. Thanks. I'm a middle manager in the social services, and I'm going to be relocating down to the D.C. area. And I'm wondering, you know, it's not a profession that pays a whole lot of money, so I don't know how interested headhunters might be in assisting me, but is there any role for headhunters with a middle manager in social services who might either be looking for a not-for-profit job or government work?
There are some out there. They're rare. Nonprofits tend not to pay headhunters to do searches for them. So I'm sorry to tell you, your odds are probably pretty slim.
Well, I figured as much, but, you know, I'm doing my due diligence, and it's kind of interesting to hear the conversation. So back to my tried-and-true methods, then.
Right. Well, good luck, Charlie. The good news for you, Charlie, is that I think in the recession, one of the only sectors of job growth in America has actually been public sector employment.
It's true.
Well, don't I know it, and that's why I'm heading down to D.C., although not that New York's bad, but I'm ready for a change. I'm basically a kind of guy who does 2 or 3 years here and there in a different program, cleans it up, and moves on, so I'm hoping for something good.
We have a hand up in the audience, but we also have only a minute left, so ask a real quick 15-second question.
This is fairly short. I'd like to follow up on what this gentleman was talking about. If he did his due diligence thoroughly and profile each company that he thought he might like to work for, wouldn't that include finding out, and could he find out, what they offer for the job he's thinking of? and then he could use that in seeing whether they can make him a good offer or not.
You can do that, but my advice is don't worry about what a company offers other people. Ask yourself, what could you be worth to this company? And when you walk in the door, you need to be able to present something of a business plan to the manager and say, here's how I'm going to improve your bottom line by doing X, Y, and Z. Then you have a lot more leverage to negotiate a higher salary.
That's Nick Korkadilos, live from WNYC's Green Space earlier this year. And that's a good note to end on as any this hour. We hope you found something useful in our discussions with Nick this Labor Day. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Stick around. Lots more next hour.